AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here for this interview episode with David Canfield.
Hello.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
And you guys conducted our two interviews this week with two very different people who maybe over the course of our introducing them will find some unexpected connections between. But first, David, let's hear your conversation with Barry Keoghan, who is part of the outstanding ensemble cast of The Banshees of Inisherin from Martin McDonagh. What was talking to Barry like?
He's a delight, and he's a far cry from the manipulative, menacing characters he's been known for in the past. But in this movie, he plays a kind of lovable, tragic fool. And I would say his persona is maybe somewhere between the two types.
You know, I still think of him as the kid in Over His Head in Dunkirk. So maybe that captured his essence in some way.
There you go. He's really wonderful in this movie. I think the whole cast is. It's a pretty incredible company of four core actors here. And this was an experience for him that was surprising to me. He was coming off of a really difficult personal period, and he kind of just got lost on this island in this story and really, I think, valued the collaboration he was able to have with Martin McDonagh, Colin Farrell, with whom he's worked before, and a story that seemed to hit him pretty close to home.
Well, I can't wait to hear about all of that. Let's hear your conversation with Barry Keoghan.
Hi, Barry. Welcome to Little Gold Men.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. We're talking to you about The Banshees of Inisherin, which I think is one of the best films of the year.
Oh, thanks, man.
You play sweet, poor Dominic.
Poor sweet Dominic.
Eh? Poor sweet Dominic. I would guess that the first time you read a Martin McDonagh script, especially one that's this good as an actor, is pretty exciting.
I mean, again, you know, again, using the word feckin', that's how, you know, embedded it is in me. But yeah, I mean, reading the script for the first time, it really did touch me. You know, I've never laughed as much either. You know, and at the same time, I felt really sympathetic to Dominic and a lot of the characters as well. It was tragic. It was depressing. There was a roller coaster in there for me. And I went and read it straight away again and then just text Martin. I was like, I want to do it. I mean, I was going to do it either way. You know, as soon as I got the email off Martin McDonagh, I'm like, I'm in. I don't even have to read it. I'm doing it.
Yeah. You weren't necessarily who I would have thought of for this kind of part. I mean that in the best way in terms of your performance. Did you see yourself in it immediately? I mean, how did you sort of figure the character versus who you've played and what this would be versus that?
Yeah, you know what? I'm all about, you know, and I mean this in the best way and without coming across in any other way, but I do look at the roles I play and how I can challenge myself in every role. And I do want people to kind of see range and that I can go to other places rather than the sinister parts that I've played before, you know.
You've got that covered, yeah.
I've got that covered and, you know, this was a chance to kind of show that I can, you know, come across innocent with a bit of naivety, with a bit of, you know, a pure soul and honesty. And so I really did want to tackle that. And, you know, and the whole physical element of Dominic, I brought that into it and chatted with Martin and, you know, his traits and his walk, his manner, his, you know, it's, again, for an actor, it was a dream role. But I really did want to push it and bring people into that kind of world of, you know, I can make you feel as well, rather than make you hate me and be sinister and with an absolute evil demeanor.
I did see that you described the Joker, who you play in The Batman and its final tag, as a broken down boy. So there are some similarities.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. But no, I do mean that in, you know, Martin's movies and scripts, they're all, you know, he's a playwright. He's an incredible playwright. And, you know, there's that element to it there as well, that their characters, every character is so individual in that sense that, you know, they're so, you know, as an actor, they're so chunky and there's so much to dive into. And so he gave me a lot that I could work with. And then we got discussing and just, you know, we had different versions of Dominic that we wanted to tell, and, you know, how far we push him and, you know, how we humanize him, how we, you know, those lots. But I'd a feckin' dream on this. I really did.
Yeah, I can tell. It's a fun part. And I did want to ask you about the physicality, because it's the kind of transformation you almost can't quite notice at first until you're like, mm-hmm. oh, this is, you know, you're walking in a totally different way. You're mm-hmm. moving your head in a totally different way. Like, step by step, what did that look like for you in just terms of finding that part of the character?
It was all thought out, and it was, you know, I have these Moleskine books and I, you know, I have one book for physicality and one book for experiences that relate to my experiences, etc. And then I have one with random character questions, and I fill all of that in and see how I can change it up and see how it all relates to me as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've done a lot of work on that and kind of being on the island as well. You take that into factor and you look at, you know, rural Ireland to inner city Dublin, where I'm from. And, you know, there's a big, big difference in how one holds themselves and that, and then the time period. But it was just kind of, you know, I thought of a fox a lot, you know, the kind of timid, shy, you know, intelligent, as I think Dominic is really intelligent. I thought of that a lot as Dominic, you know, and very isolated on his own as well, and a survivor almost. There was a lot of that went into it. And as well, I was going through a really tough time at that time as well, personally as well. So I think I was kind of in a haze as well, that I couldn't get too deep into it and you know, preempt too much. But yeah.
Hmm. It's an emotionally intense role in a lot of ways too, just in terms of what he goes through, mm-hmm. given what you were experiencing. Did you find that overlap personally difficult at all?
You know, I relate to a lot with Dominic. I really do. And I won't get into it, but like he's just a pure, genuine soul. And he's got this attitude I do admire of, you know, every day is a new day kind of attitude. And there's hope. He's always hoping and he's always wanting to see the brighter side. And he has this kind of childlike factor as well. There's no filter. When he says stuff, the way children say stuff to adults, they're not being considerate of their feelings, really. You know, they're going to say it, what they think, and be pure, honest. And I think Dominic has that. He sees it how it is, and he says it how it is, and, you know, whether that hurts your feelings or not. I think that's a bit of energy injected into everyone else. And, you know, he's that little kind of bright bit of positivity, kind of hope in the movie, along with Carrie's character as well, I think.
No, absolutely. He brings a light for sure.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting too, because you almost have to find your way into the story in a different way. Like when I think of Killing of a Sacred Deer or even Eternals, you're playing manipulators. You're playing mm-hmm. characters who manipulate the story. And here it's kind of the opposite in a way, where he's sort of finding his way in a much more pure way, and almost the forces around him are sort of dictating his journey.
No, yeah, and you're dead right, the characters around him as well. But, you know, it's you're dead right about Eternals and Sacred Deer. You know, and the biggest challenge for me is I'm the one that kind of, you know, I have to prove wrong. I'm always the one kind of setting up challenges for myself. But it is nice to go and play a character like this and go against the grain almost into what people are used to seeing me play. And it's fun. It's a breath of fresh air. It's, you know, being in that circle, that McDonough circle. You've got, you know, that caliber there. You've got Brendan, Colin, Kerry. It's It's just, yeah, they make it a lot easier as well.
How did you find those rhythms? I mean, of the four main actors in the film, you are the, I believe, the only one who hadn't worked with Martin, you know, regularly before. Did they mm-hmm. have their kind of ways? Did you find your way in? What was that like?
You know, I mean, very inviting. They were like, I met Martin. I had Martin on the front of my phone. Long story. So long story short. So I have this list of directors that I want to work with, and I've had it for ages. I had Yorgos on there, Chloe Zhao, and, you know, Emerald Fennell, and all these directors.
You're checking them off.
and Martin was on it, and I then got an email from Martin saying, I broke this script, I'd love you to play this part. And I was like, wow. So then I went as far as putting Martin on the front of my phone, a picture of him, because I'm a big believer in combination with being spiritual and, you know, law of attraction, and, you know, if you visualize it. And again, I think it's visualizing it to get the opportunities rather than get it what it is you want. You've to get the opportunity, I think, and then work for it. But anyways, I had him on the front of my phone, and, you know, literally he then set up a meeting in Midtown New York, and he was like, let's go get some food and chat about this script. And it was up until I sat down and I was waiting on him to come in, he was still on the front of my phone. And I was like, I'd best remove this picture of Mark, because he will think I'm insane, man. He'll think, what a weird little kid. You know what? I'm going to pass on you. But yeah, it's, you know, it's, yeah, it was quite nice to get that email off him as well, to be honest. He is one of the best, and you know, so good in the sense of how he talks to his actors and communicates, and he was there again. He was there for me, and he looked out for me. And again, I was, you know, going through a bit of a tough one right before we filmed, and I got some sort of an infection in my arm, and I was quite, you know, I was in pain and stuff like that, and it was kind of an infection, but, you know, and it was kind of a whether I could and not I could do the film, because it was quite severe. But Martin was there to guide me through it and remind me that we're in a good place to do this. And so I mean that when I say he's been there from the start, and he's been, you know, any problems I had on set, him and Colin and Brendan and Kerry, you know, they were right beside me. Because it is quite intimidating going into a Martin McDonagh world, and everyone's worked together already, and you're kind of the newbie. Right. So he was alongside me, even delivering my lines for me at one stage and being like, Dominic does it this way and Dominic does it that way. And yeah.
Wow. That's special, though. I mean, to have that kind of trust, I would think, in a company.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I do trust them a lot. Yeah. So I'm very, very grateful.
Did you guys do rehearsal beforehand, or what was the process of especially getting to the island and being in that bubble like?
And I just skipped the rehearsal because, you know, I got this, it's called necrotizing fasciitis, but I got that infection. I had to skip. I couldn't literally do rehearsal. So I came in quite late to it. And again, this is what I'm saying, but it's so inviting and so there for me, and, you know, helped me get there. It's I didn't rehearse, no. I know Colin and that did. I mean, we read a few scenes here and there, but in terms of doing a heavy rehearsal, I know the lads did, yeah. Brendan, Kerry and Colin, but I didn't get a chance to.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So Colin's an actor you've, of course, worked with before, and he's your I would say, your main scene partner here.
Yeah.
So I think you guys kind of fell back into a dynamic to an extent.
Yeah, we did. He's, you know, Colin, above all, he's just, I mean this in, you know, in the most best way. He is like, he's always been there for me. And any problems I've had, or, you know, he's there for advice. And he's just such a great human being and a smashing actor that I continue to watch and learn from. And any chance that I can, and if Colin's involved, I'm there, I'm doing it. But he is, yeah, it was great to kind of team up with him again under a different, you know, movie. And but that duo thing is quite nice that we tend to do.
Yeah, you do tend to do that.
Yeah.
It's also a more vulnerable kind of connection between you as actors, just in terms of where the characters are. Mm-hmm. Did you see something new in him as an actor this time? And maybe did that bring something out in you? I'm just curious.
I did. I seen him be so vulnerable. I remember seeing the film for the first time. I texted him. I said, you and Brendan, and Carrie, but I said, because I was texting him, I was like, you give the best performance. I think, if you don't mind me saying, but I think you give the best performance of your life, man. It's like, I sympathized with him so much in it. You know, I felt for him. And physically, he's like, the shoulders are down and it's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And to be with him in that, and I almost thought he was Dominic to Cullum, to Brendan's character almost. It was kind of like a mirror kind of thing going on. But I was just watching and learning and just seeing him taking it to a new level. He really was so immersed in it.
How do you generally feel about watching yourself, and how did you feel about watching yourself in this movie?
I hate watching myself. I really do. I hate it. It's, can you watch yourself back on podcasts?
No, I don't even like this. I don't.
No, I mean, I'm like, you know what? Yeah. I do. It's hard. I've seen it once, and again, I will watch it again, but, we tend to be very, very critical of ourselves, and I just don't want to put myself in that place. But I also see it as a learning curve, and I don't ever want to get to a place where I think I absolutely nailed it, because, again, there's no room for improving, and I constantly want to figure this craft out and what it is that I'm doing, and, that's the exciting part of it. So I watch and I learn from myself and also from others, back to the question, I don't like watching myself. No.
Yeah. In conclusion.
conclusion.
Yeah. I saw Chloe Zhao once describe you as an actor who, she said, cannot be tamed. Again, as a compliment. Is that something, though, that you like to bring to set, a sense of wildness? Because I'm also curious about director to director, how they would interpret that, maybe.
I love that. That's brilliant. Cannot be tamed. She said, yeah, I seen that. She like put me in the same sentence as a wolf. I was like, wow. Chloe's amazing. See, Chloe works with you watch The Rider and that. It's, how she gets performances from non-actors. And, she has a way of working and a way of communicating with her actors as well. And she's so, I put all my trust in her as well. And even with Eternals, There was ways, because I can get quite intimidated sometimes, or with lines and dyslexic, and I get a bit frazzled, and she has a way of working with me and understanding me. And same with Martin and Emerald and all of the directors I've worked with. They understand me in a sense, and I think Chloe's coming from that background of, seeing non-actors not being trained, and I think maybe that's the tamed thing she's on about. I don't know, but I wasn't trained as an actor, so I think it's kind of trying to keep that spontaneity, kind of not being tamed into one. But I like it, whatever it means.
You'll take it.
I'll take it.
Yeah, I was thinking the audition tape of you for the Batman recently came out.
Oh, yeah,
and I thought that it's not every actor that would share their own audition tape on social media, but you did do that.
Mm-hmm. I did. Yeah, I'm. You know what? I remember seeing that they were making the Batman, and I was obsessed with the Riddler, and I was like, I'd love to play the Riddler, and I just thought about putting a little visual together in that way. I'm literally just walking down the corridor and adding some music and a feel to it and a swag and a mysterious element thing going on. And I wanted to put a visual out there. And again, I met Dylan Clark for General, and I mentioned it to him. And, and then they seen it. But, Paul Dano does an exceptional job. And I'm not taking away from that fact, but yeah, I mean, the Joker came out of it, so I was quite happy with
something
that.
Came out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great little short film, though.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, do you want to see the full movie? I mean, where
is yeah. Who knows what that movie would look like?
I'm always on that kind of thing. If you want something, you know, you got to go out and go for it, or, you know. And my thing is about if I'm making something like that, or if I want something, I'm going to show you my version, because, again, one thing, I can't guarantee I'll get the part or promise I'll get the part, but I can promise you that you're going to see something that you've never seen, which is my version, you know, because no one else can do that.
Hmm. Yeah.
God, I sound so cocky there. No one else can do that. But you know what I mean.
Well, but it's true. Like,
your version is your version. Yeah. No one else can do your version. And that's what I'm trying to say.
You're going to bring your own thing to it. I totally get what you mean. How did that go with Martin? Like, what was your spin on that character?
Again, I wanted everything to be, you know, totally pure and honest and, you know, no filter and not play comedy or not play. I never go for playing anything. I just totally in it. And The Island done that itself. I mean, it immersed you and it made you feel, you know, I remember one day I was looking to the right, it was the set, and then literally to the left is the Atlantic Ocean and the States is the next stop. And, you know, and just that, looking to the left, I totally forgot where I was. And it had that beautiful thing, that island, of just kind of making you feel that numb, that euphoric kind of, that state of not even knowing where you are for, like, even if it's for 2 seconds. But that all added to Dominic, you know, it really did, that The Island life, it really all added to Dominic. But I had a lot of fun playing him. And I do want to continue to play different characters that people don't think I can play. And
so an example, what's something that is way out there for you?
Again, like another dark comedy would be amazing to do. Or just, you know, I don't want to pitch anything, because it always gets brought into the media. Barry's pitching for this. Barry wants to work with him. I was like, no.
Right.
You know, I'll see what comes in. But I do want to show range. I mean, that's the best thing you can hope for. I want to be challenged. I want to challenge myself above all.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Emerald Fennell. You're starring in a new film. I'm sure you can't say virtually anything about it, but is that another example of you getting that kind of opportunity?
Yeah. You know what? Emerald gave me a great opportunity there, and I'm very grateful to her. I mean that. She is she's exceptional, and had an amazing time working with her, and I'm really excited to see what people think of this movie. I mean, it's shot beautifully as well, Linus, and it's just across the board, it's just amazing. And again, just, yeah, we just wrapped it there, and it's going to be feckin' amazing.
Feckin' amazing.
I can promise you that.
Yeah. If you brought some Martin McDonagh to that script, that I would not complain.
Some feckin' this, feckin' that.
Yeah.
I know, I keep saying feckin' now, man. It's a great little word. It's not a coarse word, so you can kind of get away with it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, feckin'. Ah.
And it shows that the role, the project really stayed with you.
Yeah, it did. It did. You know, and again, I'm here in New York now and, you know, feeling it and being a part of it and seeing the lads last night, and I haven't got to see Kerry yet, but, you know, just being it, I'm very, very proud of this movie. Very proud of it. It's the most Irish movie you can be a part of, and, you know.
Well, I think that's interesting. I mean, this is an awards podcast. It's an incredibly Irish movie, and I'm wondering your general feeling on the fact of the movie having a kind of campaign life, getting out there for it, especially for a movie that feels so Irish, and it's Martin's first Irish feature. It's set in these incredible locations, as you were saying. In terms of the movie getting that kind of embrace, how does that sit with you?
I mean, if it goes there, it goes there, and you know, that's a bonus. It's done incredibly well already, and people seem to love it. And again, I think people relate with it, because it's a movie that, you know, it doesn't hold anything else to it. There's no underlying thing to it. It's basically about it's a massive breakup movie. And, you know, we've all had that experience. I mean, most of us anyways. And it can exist now or exist 100 years ago, or you know, and that's the beauty of it. And I think that's a breath of fresh air again, going to see a movie like that, that doesn't, it's not about so-and-so or this and this. And it's just, it's enjoyable, you know, and it makes you feel. And it reminds me of The Field in a sense, you know, it's about a man in his field and, or The Old Man and the Gun, David Lowery's movie. You know, it's movies that are, you know, it's just really fucking enjoyable. But if it does get, you know, and hopefully, you know, I'm really excited for it. That'll be another bonus, so.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, Rebecca, now let's hear your conversation with Ruben Östlund, whose movie has been the discussion of, like, film world since Cannes, really. And I think now that Triangle of Sadness is opening in theaters, more people, myself included, get to find out, like, what everyone has been saying was so outrageous when the movie first premiered. They were right. It is really outrageous. And I'm very curious about what it's like to talk to the person who made that happen.
I think maybe this is what these two people have in common, because I sort of, you know, when you look at his films, he's pointing out a lot of the ugly side of humanity in a sort of satirical way. But he is just a delight as well, and and totally loves people and loves life. And so I didn't know what to expect with him, but he was really interesting to talk to, and talked a lot about how he sort of comes up with these ideas by talking to people. Like, he'll say, I'm making a movie about airplanes, and then everyone he talks to will tell him an airplane story, and then he creates his ideas based on what he hears from other people.
That sounds like a good way to have people come up to you and be like, that's what you think of me? Or like, that's how you use my story?
That is terrifying in the context of what's in this movie, however.
Like, yeah, it's true.
It's so true. But he... the original idea for this movie came from his wife, who's a fashion photographer, and really showed him into this world of high fashion modeling. And then he sort of explains where it went from there, because if you see this movie, it just goes to the wildest places. So it was interesting to see how he got there from here's the fashion world.
Yeah. Yeah. You can imagine anyone who hears enough stories from that world in particular, they can spin out some crazy scenarios from there. Let's hear more from your conversation with Ruben Östlund.
I'm so excited to welcome Ruben Östlund to the podcast. His latest film, Triangle of Sadness, won the Palme in Cannes and is now available in theaters. Ruben, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So I saw the film in Cannes, and I had such a wonderful experience seeing it with an audience. I think you really get to watch the audience react. So I'm curious for you, do you enjoy watching your films with an audience? Have you sat through with this one? What's that like for you?
Well, you know, during the editing process, I do a lot of test screenings with an audience. I just want to sit down with an audience and watch the film in order to figure out how it should be edited, how the pace should be, in order to create a dynamic experience. So the first screenings you do with an audience is kind of painful, because then you have a movie that is maybe 4 hours long or 3 hours and 40 minutes, but you know that you have to go through this in order to figure out exactly how to maneuver the energy in the room of a cinema. And at that point, it's not so pleasant to watch it through with an audience. But as soon as you're starting to get a rhythm that is working out well, then it's enjoyable. At least with this film, it has been really, really enjoyable.
Yeah. I think especially for a lot of people who haven't been in theaters for a couple of years because of the pandemic, this is just one of those movies that proves how special that experience is. But maybe you could tell me sort of where the initial idea for this movie comes from. Do you have sort of a lightning moment, or is it something where you're thinking about an idea for a while and then the film comes together?
Well, it started 8 years ago when I met my wife. We met in LA, and she was there and doing a fashion shoot. She's a fashion photographer. And I got very curious about her profession, because it's a kind of industry that you have been looking on from the outside. And it's a little scary also, that industry, because everything that is connected to beauty, you know, beauty is also telling us so much about hierarchies. So I thought it was interesting to hear someone from the inside tell me different aspects of her work. And there was a few things that I got interested in already at that point. And one of them was in which way the fashion industry are selling their clothes. And if you look at the different strategies depending on the brand and how expensive the brand is. So she, for example, told me, like, if you look at campaigns for H&M or Zara, the more cheaper brands, then the models are very often smiling.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then the more expensive the brand gets, that smile is disappearing from the face of the models. And the most expensive brands like Balenciaga or Hermes or I don't know, then the models are basically looking down on you when you're looking on these big campaigns and posters and billboards and so on. And then you, of course, understand that, okay, when you buy clothes, you also buy a kind of camouflage for the certain kind of social group that you connect yourself to. So if you want to be connected to the social group that is on top of our society, okay, you have to put a lot of money into it. And then the more cheaper brands down there, and then it's like, and then you're lower down in the hierarchies, so to speak. So that was one aspect of it. But then what really wanted me to make the movie was when she started to tell me stories about the models. And she told me quite much about the male models. And I thought it was very interesting that they earn like 1/4 of what the female models are doing, which is basically not so strange because women are consuming much more fashion and beauty products and so on. But she told me also about a male model, a friend of hers, that when he was 19 years old, he worked as a car mechanic, and he were living on the countryside of Germany, and he went into Hamburg, which is the city where the fashion industry is in Germany, and he got street casted. Someone came up to him and asked, do you want to try out to be a model? And you know, it's not really a high status profession to be a male model in the same way it is for the women. So he was like, well, okay, I can try that. And then, you know, 2 years later, he's one of the best paid male models in the industry. And he does a perfume campaign, which is the most prestigious thing you can do as a model. Then it's only your face, and you know, like your face becomes connected to the brand, and those campaigns are lasting much longer. And if I showed you these images, you would recognize this guy, and you'd say, "Ah, it's him." So now this car mechanic, young man, is 21 years old and have gotten used to a complete different lifestyle in only 2 years. So I got very interested in the aspect of beauty as a currency. So, you know, that beauty can make us climb in class society. And the thing with being a model is, of course, that the career is not very long. And the female models, they can say things like, you know, yeah, I'm going to marry rich. I'm going to be a trophy wife. That's the way for me to maintain the same, how to say, lifestyle and get out of the industry. But for men, it's not really the same thing. And what happened to this guy was that when he were there up on the top, he all of a sudden realizes, oh, I'm losing my hair. I'm getting bald. And he had a talk to his agent, and his agent said, okay, maybe you have 2 more years, depending on like how it goes with your hair problem. But we also have another problem, and it is that you are so connected with this perfume brand. So no one wants to book you on the same level, the same kind of prestigious jobs. So it would be really, really great if you get together with a famous girlfriend. And this guy goes like, okay, but I want to be in love. And the agent's like, but yeah, okay, but maybe you can find a win-win, you know. So I thought it was very interesting to look at how the strategy of economy goes down to every single individual, and we are starting to look at each other as like a business model, and even into the most private parts of our lives, we are relating to ourselves like a business. That was the starting point, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we hear about those sort of Hollywood, actor and actress dating relationships for promotion as well. But it's funny to see it play in the modeling world in your film. And so how much research did you do? You know, because I think you set this on a cruise for a part of the film and this sort of luxury experience. There's a lot of, you know, one percenters on this cruise, and they're all very full characters. So I'm curious, where does that inspiration come from? Do you do a lot of research, or how do you build these characters?
Of course, I do a lot of research, and I think I was inspired of like a couple of different characters because I fell in love with different dialogues, basically. So I had this British couple that it's arms dealers. And I love the awkward situation, you know, when you're sitting around the dining table and you ask them, so what do you do? And they go like, well, our products have been involved in conflicts for democracy all over the world. It's like, what kind of product is that? Well, basically, our best-selling product is the hand grenade, you know. So, and then one idea I had was that I wanted to portray them all as nice. I didn't want to make them like ignorant or mean to someone else or so on, because I think that is maybe the conventional way when we look at class, that when we describe people that are on the bottom, they're genuine and generous. And when you look at rich people, they are egoistic and superficial. And I didn't want to go down that road because I don't believe it's true. And then, of course, I had this idea about having a captain on the boat that was a Marxist. So it was a lot of the things that came out of the idea of this Marxist captain getting really drunk together with the Russian oligarch and having a lot of fun when they are discussing their different political standpoints. And my idea that they should get so drunk so they start playing with the microphone system during a storm, and that the captain should read from the Communistic Manifest to these vomiting passengers of a luxury yacht. So,
that scene will never leave my head, I think. It's just such a great scene. And I'm curious, specifically for that scene, you know, on screen it looks like such intense chaos, but what was it like actually shooting it for you and the actors?
It was an intense chaos because we were shooting on a set that was rocking. So we had the set built on a gimbal. So we built a dining room, one of the corridors, and a cabin that we could rearrange to make it look at many different cabins. And, you know, when you shoot something on a set that is rocking and you're spending like 10 hours a day on that set, people get seasick for real. So part of the crew had to eat seasick pills in order to managing the shooting.
Oh, my gosh. So, when this film came out, or at Cannes, I guess, was its debut, and now it's played in a lot of theaters, have you gotten any surprising reactions to it? Because I think people react very differently after experiencing it.
I mean, if you go into the political parts of it, some people are saying, it's too simple. It's too simple. Like, you know, when you get one person that was really, he was standing up and was angry, actually. And I said, give the mic to that gentleman. And he's like, okay, it's too simple. And I tried to ask him, what is too simple? And he didn't really want to point out. So, okay, is it maybe this thing about the class society that it's dealing with? And I go in and talk a little bit about Rutger Bregman, that is an author that I like a lot. And he had been in Davos to talk to philanthropists about his latest book at that time. It was called Utopia for Realist. And he was starting to talk about like philanthropy, and that he believed in like that we should pay tax, like that we have to stop the bullshitting and pay taxes. And when I tell this to this guy, he leaves. And afterwards, they are telling me, you know, that's one of the richest people in France. It was in Paris the screening was, and he's a big philanthropist. So I guess that that's the most surprising reaction that I have had so far.
That's so interesting. It's interesting because I would say this film is very complicated. There's a whole third act that I don't want to talk about because I think people really enjoy being surprised where the film goes. But I am curious, when you write a screenplay like this, do you know where it's going to end up when you start? Do you have the ending in mind already at the beginning?
Yes, I do. Not maybe from the absolute beginning. The project for me started with like the thematic and the aspect of looking at beauty as a currency. And then I knew that I wanted to go to luxury yacht. And then I came up with the last part. And I mean, what I think is interesting to change environment where the characters are dealing with the situations that is put up to them in the film is that you can turn the pyramid around with some setups. You can point out like, okay, in this kind of environment, our behavior is going to change, or here we have to relate to, okay, the captain is highest in the hierarchy and so on. So I knew that I wanted to have this three-part structure.
Yeah, the shift of power is just so fascinating in the film, and I think makes it so enjoyable to watch. I'm curious for you as a writer, director, what part of this filmmaking process do you find most difficult, whether that's pre-production or writing or directing or post? What's the hardest part for you?
The pre-production is always quite fun, I think. You know, when I love to talk about projects with basically everyone I meet, and I like to tell them about, okay, this is what you're going to experience in the film. And so often when I do that, people are coming back with input to me, and that sometimes they're like genius. So I just bring it in, I steal it, and I put it into the script. So that is that, and then there all the possibilities are there. You know, you can go whatever direction you want. Then when it starts to narrow down and you start to decide, this is exactly how I want it, then starts the struggle of like, how do I visualize this? How do I manage to do it in a way that I can, that I like imagining it in my head? And from that point, it's a struggle from every single day when you aren't shooting, for an example. Every single day when I'm going to set and I'm shooting, I feel like, oh my God, this is turning out so bad. And hopefully you manage to like with the acting and the camera angles and so on, find a way that you like how you're shooting the scene. And if you're lucky, then you feel like, wow, it was better than I expected. And then when it comes to the editing, it's also like, it's about stamina really to be a director, I would say.
And the film features a ton of amazing performances. And I think seeing Charlotte B. Dean perform in this film, it just felt like she was going to go on to be such a big star. And how has it been for you to, you know, because she recently passed away, to have the film come out and not have her present for this?
Well, this is almost only 1 month ago, a little bit longer. And we were supposed to go on this tour together where we were going to the different festivals and presenting the film and with the ensemble. And for me, it was a film where we were like really collaborating quite good, all of us together. And I think Charlotte was a team player, really. And she was lifting up her colleagues and she was lifting up everybody in the film crew. And so she gave a lot of energy to us when we were, to all of us when we were making the film. And to get that message was, of course, a shock, and felt very empty to not have her next to us. And maybe also especially, we got to share Cannes together, which I'm happy for. But as you said, it would be so interesting also to see where this would take her and which direction she would go after this movie. And of course, then her family is dealing with something that is much harsher than us that made the film. But yeah, she will be missed.
Yeah. So when you look at, you know, Force Majeure, The Square, sort of your recent trio of films, what do you sort of see in common about the stories you're telling now? Do you feel like there's a through line for you?
I think they're all kind of different, the movies, but maybe the common red thread is that there's a main character that is dealing with gender expectations in some way. And it's a little bit of like modern time issues or contemporary time issues of being a man that is in all of the three films. So even though I didn't think about the films like this on forehand, but when I was cutting Triangle of Sadness, I felt again, okay, it's a trilogy about being a man in our times. And I think also it can be quite interesting sometimes to look back on the three different male characters that goes through the film and compare them. And yeah, maybe it's a good starting point for an interesting discussion of being how it is to be a man.
I feel like this is perfect for a college course in gender studies. Okay. They should show your three films.
Don't go the same way as this main character. Avoid these kind of actions.
When you look back on your film so far, do you have one that's your favorite, or is it impossible to pick a favorite child?
It is a little bit like that, of course. But I made a film called Play, 2011, and Play was dealing with a certain kind of events that took place in my home city, in Gothenburg, in Sweden, on the West Coast, where there was a group of very young people robbing other young people in the center of the city. And these robbers, they had one thing in common, and it was that they were black. And it created a very controversial image that provoked a lot of questions on what we project on skin color, of prejudice, etc. So that film, I mean, when that film was released in Sweden, I felt there was really a lack of discussion about representation, about like how we are reproducing prejudice with the fiction movies and popular culture, etc. So that film, I think it like it created such a debate like in the Swedish society that I'm very, very proud of. And I mean, for me, that is the goal when I make the movies, that try to reach out as wide as possible, of course, because that's a part of if you want to use your films in order to provoke questions. But then that to create a discussion about, okay, who do we want to be? What kind of society do we want?
Yeah, it's funny. I interviewed Woody Harrelson in Cannes, and he mentioned Play as a film that made him very interested in you as a filmmaker. So people should definitely check that out if they haven't seen it yet. And so I know you're already working on your next film. From what I understand, it's set on a plane. Can you tell me a little bit more about it and where you are in the process?
I can tell you how it ends.
But don't tell us that. No, I want that as a surprise.
Okay. No, but the title is The Entertainment System is Down. And it takes place on a long-haul flight. And I have not decided 100% which flight it should be. Maybe Stockholm, LA, or London, Sydney, or something. So one of these flights that is over 15 hours. And what happens is that quite soon after takeoff, the passengers get the announcement from the crew that unfortunately the screens on your seats in front of you is not working. It will not be any entertainment. and when iPads and phones is slowly charging out, we have these modern human beings have to deal with being bored. And we don't have those small screens where we can distract ourselves constantly and like, you know, dopamine scrolling like this. And I have been interested in a sociological study that I thought pointed out a little bit of how we deal with these days with this distraction that we constantly are seeking. And it was researchers that had put a test person in a room and asked them to do nothing. And they didn't know, the test persons didn't know that the time limit was 15 minutes. And when you asked them afterwards what they felt, how this was, they were like, it was horrible. They thought it was horrible. So the researcher, they added a feature to the test, and it was that there was a button that the test persons could push voluntarily. They didn't have to do it. And if they pushed this button, they gave themselves an electrical shock that was very painful, but not harming them. And the absurdity was like that almost over 40% of the test person actually choose to push this button. So I think it's something about that, like being left alone with your thoughts, that we don't really like it. It's going to be interesting to look at our behavior in the airplane body, almost like a sociological lab.
Yeah. And where are you in the process? You're writing or you're done? Or
I'm basically in this process now that I'm telling people about the project, and they're coming back to with fun stories or things that they have observed when they have been on flights, or and also I get to know how to tell the film. So when I know how to tell the film from the beginning to the end, basically, at least I have to have a very fixed frame. Then I can sit down and write it down.
Yeah. Yeah, I think everyone has a plane horror story, so I'm sure you're going to get lots of material.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have one?
Yes, but I'm not going to tell it here.
Okay. Okay.
But maybe later. But okay. I really appreciate you giving me some of your time. And for everyone listening, please go watch Triangle of Sadness in theaters. It's a really wonderful experience to watch it with an audience, as I've mentioned. So thank you, Ruben.
Thank you so much.
That does it for today's show. We'll be back on Thursday with our regular roundtable conversation. In the meantime, find us at vanityfair.com, on Twitter at HWD, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich, and David.
David Canfield, 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
The run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that.
We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.